Today, we speak to a reporter on the ground in Venezuela as protests look set to intensify and the humanitarian crisis continues. And The Guardian's political correspondent, Jessica Elgut, on the latest Brexit showdown in Parliament.
I was completely like jam-packed in this sea of people. There were at least five or six blocks of people ahead of me and at least five or six blocks behind me. It just seemed endless. And what was so amazing also is that it had become kind of like the mirror image of all of these protests that I've been covering for the past 10 years. It used to be that the government's rallies were the ones that occupied, you know, endless blocks. This time, the government's sort of rival march was maybe one or two blocks, whereas this one for the opposition was absolutely, like I said, endless. And we found out through neighbors who were on their phones that Juan Guaido had said he would be taking over the interim presidency of Venezuela.
And that moment when you started to get news that five blocks ahead of you, he had declared himself president. What was the reaction?
It was incredible. There was this kind of like silence and then an absolute like collective roar. I suppose it could go down in history like the beginning of a new cycle for Venezuela.
It's exactly a week since the opposition politician Juan Guaido declared himself president of Venezuela. Many hope that this could mark the end of Nicolas Maduro's disastrous rule and help stem a humanitarian crisis in which hyperinflation is predicted to reach 10,000,000% this year. Others warn of a coup that could result in a damaging US-led intervention. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, as protests intensify, what next for crisis-stricken Venezuela? Guardian reporter Virginia Lopez has been covering this story on the ground in Venezuela. How bad are things in Venezuela at the moment?
They're so bad that 3 million people have left. And they're so bad that if there isn't a change within the horizon, more people are probably going to leave. Just to give you an idea, the UN has said that they expect close to 5 million people leaving, you know, in the next coming years. This influx of people is something that the Colombia, Brazil, and all the regional countries can probably not sustain. Venezuela was traditionally a country of immigrants, so that a lot of Venezuelans hold dual nationalities. Just to give you an example, there's 200,000 Spanish citizens in Venezuela at the moment. So the thought that Spain could be receiving 200,000 Venezuelan Spanish dual citizens, or Italy or Portugal, is I think something that is worrying the international community quite a lot.
And what are people fleeing from?
Just dire hunger, a lack of services. There's no cooking gas in most of the popular sectors of the society. There's cities that have been without electricity for not hours or days, but weeks. To give you an example of just how strange living in Venezuela is, this is one of the things I saw during the rally that really, really struck me. There were a bunch of bills on the pavement that somebody had thrown as a protest, the fact that the currency here is worthless. And what was so incredible was to think that here were, you know, perfectly minted bills that were so worthless that nobody was picking them up. This is truly a desperate situation.
And you live there. Do you live in Caracas?
I do, yes. And I have for the last 20 years.
For you as an individual, what is it like to live in Venezuela?
primarily, it's incredibly sad. This was once the wealthiest country in the region. I definitely didn't think that I was going to see the past of this country destroyed. I never thought that I wasn't going to, you know, grow up without my friends from childhood. So many of my friends have left, but also so many of my friends have been the victims of violent crime. And I'm not talking about being held at gunpoint. I'm talking about, you know, being killed. And this wasn't because they were in the wrong part of the city at the wrong time. This is because somebody decided to break into their house. The break-in went wrong and they were killed. This isn't an isolated instance. This has happened to a handful of my friends or their brothers or their parents, including myself.
You've been attacked.
My house was broken into. My parents' house was broken into with us inside. Yes, this is almost a normal occurrence amongst us. You're considered lucky if you live to tell it. This is not something that I could have thought of when I was growing up here. I said, you know, this is the worst nightmare that you can imagine come true.
Virginia, why are you still in Venezuela?
Because I love my country. This is the best country that I know. And it's absolutely beautiful. I cannot describe to you the natural beauty of this country. It's gorgeous. I don't want to give that up.
So last May, Nicolas Maduro won a second term as president of Venezuela with 68% of the vote. But opposition parties and many of their supporters boycotted the election. They described the polling as fraudulent. The US and other independent observers across the world agreed. And exactly a week ago today, opposition politician Juan Guaido, who leads the country's National Assembly, declared himself president. So who is he?
I would say that the vast majority of his new supporters didn't know who he was 3 weeks ago. But he's been this sort of spark of hope. He comes from a very apolitical family. That's how he described himself to me. His dad's a taxi driver in the island of Tenerife in Spain and has been for the past 17 years. Again, he's one of the many Venezuelans that had to leave the country because they couldn't see a future here.
Can you just take us through your reporting over the past week?
I've spoken to people in supermarkets. I've spoken to people in popular communities that used to be, you know, supporters of Chavez and Maduro, who are now completely disillusioned. They're also very scared because there's been some street repression in the areas where they live.
Why did you come here today?
I spoke to this woman who felt like she was sort of seeing history in the making.
He's a brave young man.
But again, she barely knew who he was.
I'd never heard of him before, and I believe this Guaido, which I call him Why Not.
You know, she kept on saying, well, you know, why not? She had this sort of joke on his name.
So if he's so unknown, what are his politics?
He belongs to a party called Voluntad Popular, or Popular Will, which is, I guess, center-right. They're, you know, more conservative than your standard Venezuelan party, but they're incredibly organized. And like I said, it's the first time that I guess Juan Guaido has managed to bring the other opposition parties together in a very long time.
Hello.
This week, you secured one of the first interviews with Juan Guaido. Absolutely key to what happens next is whether the military supports him. There's no sign of that so far. Did he think that could change?
Just as we were speaking, came in a video of the military attaché in Washington, D.C., saying that he was recognizing Guaido as his president and asking for his companions in the armed forces to join ranks behind Guaido. But Guaido also said that although this seemed a rare or an isolated instance, the truth was that according to Guaido, over 3,000 soldiers had actually broken ranks with the military. The military obviously wasn't reporting this as such, but that the discontent among soldiers was evident. Soldiers do not escape the economic crisis in the country. They are oftentimes, you know, facing the same food shortages that regular citizens do.
But does it look likely at the moment?
No, it doesn't. There hasn't been any sort of public defections or too many statements of support from soldiers to Guaido. In fact, quite the opposite. The general in charge of the military, Padrino López, has called Guaido an insolent. He's been very critical and denounced the opposition's move to take over the Maduro government.
And can you explain to us their day-to-day role in Venezuela?
They're super involved in anything that has to do with the way that the country is managed. To be more explicit, they are now in charge of the oil industry. They're in charge of food distribution. They also oversee oil mining. They're embedded in everyday activities in Venezuela.
So, do the military essentially provide the key to what happens next?
Absolutely, yes, definitely.
So Guaido must be incredibly nervous about the unfolding situation. What was his mood when you spoke to him?
He didn't deny that he was nervous.
¿Tienes miedo? Cuéntame cómo te sientes.
I asked him whether he was scared.
And
he said that you know, it wasn't easy, but that he was more scared of continuing to live in a country that was living through such an economic crisis and such a state of chaos. He also mentioned that whenever people ask him this, he often thinks of his young daughter and just sort of reminds himself that part of the reason he's doing this is so that she can have a better country, so that she doesn't have to grow up thinking that this state of anarchy is normal.
Meantime, President Trump is taking sides in the political crisis brewing in Venezuela. He's announced his support for opposition leader Juan Guaido, who has
Guaido, you say he's center-right, but he's got the support of Donald Trump, who in many ways is seen as further right-wing than that, and he's even praised Bolsonaro. I mean, is that his politics?
I don't think that that's his politics, to be perfectly honest. I don't think that Venezuela can swing from Chavismo to far right. You know, in Venezuela, far right movements have been not necessarily popular at all. It's just not part of the political culture of the country. I think that having the support of Trump and Bolsonaro is probably the equivalent of Maduro having the support of Putin and Erdogan. It's just a sort of strange geopolitics that we're seeing that is quite reminiscent of the Cold War. And that we probably don't understand quite yet.
How important is that US support?
It's crucial. I think without the support of the US and the international community, this would be no different from waves of protest that we've seen. So definitely, I think that given the fact that the rule of law in Venezuela has been broken, nothing could have been achieved without the support of the international community.
And what is Donald Trump's motivation in Venezuela?
I think that the one answer to that is probably oil. Venezuela sits atop the highest proven reserves of oil in the world. And so, you know, it would be naive to think that this is about anything other than oil. Having said that, Venezuela is increasingly becoming a threat to order in the region. And I don't think that the region can afford a massive wave of migrants crossing over to Colombia, Brazil, the Antilles, and further south or further north, if it gets to that point.
I left this building 30 years ago this week.
So Donald Trump has just appointed Elliot Abrams as special envoy to Venezuela. Why is that significant?
I can't wait to get to work on it.
Well, Elliot Abrams was in charge of the operation in Panama that saw Noriega step down from power or forcibly be removed from power. So I think it reflects how serious the U.S. is about guaranteeing that there is a change of government in Venezuela.
So there's understandable nervousness about the US role in all of this. America has just imposed new sanctions on Venezuela. And here in the UK, senior figures in the Labour Party, including Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell, have written to The Guardian this week to argue leaders like Trump are not the answer for Venezuela. They think that a US attempt at regime change could have disastrous consequences. Are people in Venezuela scared of a US intervention?
Certainly. Oh, yes. This is definitely something that is in people's minds. You know, they've got a long tradition of intervention that nobody agrees with or likes. I think that it would be silly to think that anybody in Venezuela is pro a U.S. intervention. Certainly that's, you know, a scary, horrible thought. Nobody likes the sovereignty of their country being violated. Guaido, when we spoke, said that this wasn't necessarily a threat. But the U.S. issued a statement to its citizens living in the country, asking them or suggesting that leaving the country while there were still commercial flights would be a good idea. This certainly, you know, raised alarms, and people are worried.
The massive popular demonstrations which have taken place in Venezuela over the last days have been met with indiscriminate violence.
And tell me about the UN Security Council. Is the one point at which we've had a European reaction. The UK joined up with other European countries to call for elections, and Maduro hit out at the kind of childlike demands of Europe. How significant was any of that?
I think it showed that any kind of negotiations taking place behind closed doors are probably not rendering any results. It's eliminating any possibility of a negotiated outcome to this crisis.
We reaffirm our deep belief that a peaceful and inclusive democratic solution is the only sustainable way out of the current political impasse and the severe social crisis it has provoked.
And in all of this, Maduro, his attitude has appeared to be that he doesn't really care. I mean, there was the video of him dancing while people were protesting on the streets. What do we know about how he's feeling, what he's thinking at the moment?
We have absolutely no idea what he's thinking. No, there's very little communication between the media and the government at the moment. And certainly, you know, absolutely no communication between the military and the outside world.
How important to Maduro is the support of China and Russia?
Russian-China support is crucial, certainly from the financial point of view. Venezuela now relies on bank loans that they've received from both Russia and China to sustain the economy. Also, Russia has long been a provider of weapons to Venezuela. So on that front also, you know, Russia's support is crucial.
The picture you're presenting beyond the humanitarian crisis on the ground is really quite scary. We're talking about a conflict in which the US has called for people to pick a side. And so far, the US and Europe has picked one side and Russia and China has picked another side. How nervous are people about the global tensions this could lead to?
Well, I think people are very nervous. But like I've said, and like you've said, this is also an economic crisis. So I would also say that people's main concern also is going about their daily lives.
And what do you see happening? What are the kind of critical things that could happen over the next few days?
Well, I think that this is basically a battle between the people who control the arms and the people that control the money. The U.S. freezing Venezuela's assets or making these assets available now to what they say is the presidency of Juan Guaido is also going to be a crucial aspect to the outcome of this situation. The oil industry here is responsible for 95% of the country's revenues. So whoever holds those revenues is certainly going to have an important sway on the way things are done.
And just finally, you've mentioned a few times that Juan Guaido is an unknown quantity in many ways, and that it's less about who he is as an individual and more about whether he can either be the why not man or the person who represents hope. But given that we know so little about him, is there a risk that actually he's going to provide something that people really don't want?
I think that's always a risk, of course. At the moment, he's offering very, very basic things. He's got a very sort of clear three-pronged approach, in his own words, to seize the usurpation of power, to embark on a transitional government, and to hold free and fair elections as soon as possible. That's what he said is his role. But, you know, we've seen things in other countries go wrong.
And is there any sign that Maduro will let go of power?
Absolutely none.
What would you want to see happen next?
I would like to see a peaceful negotiation that can take probably longer than a sudden change, but that can guarantee no bloodshed. I would like to see the restoration of the rule of law, and I would certainly think that free and fair elections are the culmination of this process.
And Virginia, you've mentioned how much you love the country that you live in. Do you hope and expect that you'll still be living there years into the future?
Yes, I would like that very much. And I would certainly also like to see so many of my friends and so many amazing Venezuelans come back to rebuild the country.
You can read all of Virginia Lopez's reporting on the ground in Venezuela and follow The Guardian's Latin America correspondent Tom Phillips at theguardian.com. Coming up, a day in which backbench MPs were centre stage on Brexit.
In today's non-stop world, making quality time for yourself is more important than ever. When you buy a subscription to The Guardian and The Observer, you can look forward to sitting back and leafing through every page at your own pace. From the latest groundbreaking investigations to recipes, reviews, award-winning sports coverage, and more. Subscribe before the 3rd of February and you'll save up to 52% on newspaper subscriptions for a year. Just search Guardian Subscriptions.
Now.
Order!
There was a series of votes in Parliament last night that ended up with...
The eyes to the right, 317. The noes to the left, 301.
MPs sending Theresa May back to Europe to renegotiate the backstop. Our political correspondent Jessica Elgott was in Parliament watching it unfold.
The mood in Parliament last night was quite strange. You had a lot of very cheery-looking Tory cabinet ministers. One of them was even singing as he went through the voting lobbies. He was singing, vote, vote, wherever you may be, vote, vote, vote with the DUP. And, you know, it's because you've got a kind of outbreak of Tory unity with their DUP confidence and supply partners as well to actually get something through. That seems to be, you know, something that's quite rare these days, and the only rebels were those sort of Tory Remainers who we've seen rebel on multiple things, and that it wasn't enough for them to defeat this government-backed amendment tabled by Sir Graham Brady, which looks to replace the backstop arrangement in the Brexit deal with alternative arrangements. It's quite vague on that, and essentially it's quite weird to see that the government celebrating the victory of an amendment that essentially demolishes their Brexit strategy. I mean, Theresa May spent many months insisting that this is the best deal available, that the backstop is necessary and important for protecting the Good Friday Agreement and the livelihoods of people on both sides of the border in Ireland and Northern Ireland. So yesterday, Theresa May rang Jean-Claude Juncker, the President of the European Commission, to tell him that she was going to say to MPs that she planned to ask Brussels to reopen the text of the withdrawal agreement, not a letter, not a kind of codicil that might be added to it, but she was going to say, we need to take out the red pen and start working on the text itself. And he told her that it was fruitless to ask for that. That was not something that the EU27 were going to agree to. That is something that they said again last night. But if you speak to people in Downing Street, they'll say, well, there's a number of things that the EU has always said that they could not countenance. They said, when Theresa May asked for it, that the backstop agreement, which was just supposed to just cover Northern Ireland, couldn't be extended to the whole UK. And actually, it was extended to the whole UK in order to not cause a potential customs border down the Irish Sea. So they say, although the EU often says things are impossible, sometimes when the crunch comes, they do move. And that is the thing that she is pinning her hopes on. If the EU do say no, and that was something that cabinet ministers pressed her on yesterday when she spoke to them, there doesn't actually seem to be an immediate plan B. One cabinet source told me that, you know, that question was asked, but it was not entertained by the Prime Minister. She seems very, very determined that she will extract this change, this concession from the EU. But, you know, the Downing Street are really buying themselves quite a lot of time to do this. They've said that they'll return to Parliament by February the 13th, but not necessarily with another vote on a withdrawal agreement. It will be possibly another vote, but it also could be a statement on the withdrawal agreement. And if it's a statement, then they'll have to lay another motion like the one that was tabled yesterday, and that will also be subject to amendments. So it's very, very possible that before we get a chance to vote on another version of Theresa May's Brexit deal, we could have another round of amendments like these. I do think that there are so many individuals in this parliament who are prepared to really put their careers on the line to try and stop no deal. But even if the majority of MPs are against no deal, they also voted to trigger Article 50, and Article 50 will expire on March 29th, and without a deal, then we are going out without a deal. And unless someone proactively tables something to stop that happening, then, you know, the default option is no deal.
That's it for today. My thanks to Virginia Lopez and Jessica Elgott. Today's episode was produced by Rose Delarabiti, Amar Kalia and Josh Kelly. Sound design was by Axel Cocoutier. The executives are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. See you tomorrow.